Listener discretion advised. We talk about dead bodies a little bit, and I say the word damn a lot in this episode. Fair warning. This is Ann Arbor Stories. I'm your fine damn historian, Rich Reddy. The Huron River watershed in southeast Michigan travels 130 miles from White Lake Township in Oakland County all the way down to Lake Erie. The headwaters originating in Indian Springs Metro Park, twisting and turning southwest then southeast, meandering through Dexter, Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti, Belleville, Flat Rock, and Rockwood, and branching into 24 major tributaries along the way. The name Huron was chosen by French settlers who attributed it to the Native Americans who lived near the mouth of the river near Detroit. The natives themselves called the Huron Gewittatawabasibi, or Burnt Oak Region, referring to their method of managing the woods on the banks of the river. They burnt large patches of trees next to the river to enrich the soil, clear brush for crops, and attract game. University of Michigan professor and civil engineer William Hode published an essay on the Huron in the 1949 autumn edition of the Michigan Alumnus about the Huron called The Little River of Michigan. He describes its characteristics a lot better than I can. Quote, "One does not have to be a regularly ordained geologist to note that the Huron River is a youthful stream. The Huron's headwaters are gathered haphazardly from little lakes and swamps and spring-fed brooks scattered over the broad moraine which was built up between the Saginaw and Erie lobes of the last great ice invasion. From Dexter to Ypsilanti is perhaps the most beautiful part of the valley, for here the hills close in and the highway crosses back and forth from side to side, seeking an adequate foothold. The bordering hills, the wooded slopes, the winding roads, the sunny beaches, the overhanging trees, all these agreeable surroundings are but the setting for the central jewel of the valley, which is the water itself. The Huron is not a flashy stream. On the contrary, it is fairly steady in its habits as rivers go. One reason the flow of the Huron is so steady is the numerous lakes with which it's connected act to some extent as equalizing reservoirs, filling up to higher levels in winter and spring and doling out their excess waters during the summer." End quote. Flatboat operations transported goods along the Huron River from Ypsilanti to Lake Erie until railroads expanded into the region and the river found another business use. By the 1880s, 17 dams were operating at various points on the Huron, powering sawmills, flour mills, and wool mills. The Argo Mills Dam was the only one within the Ann Arbor city limits, built in 1830 to power flour and wool mills on the Huron. The power they generated was small spark plugs until 1887, when the first hydroelectric plant opened in California, sparking a new source of energy for the Great Lakes. The Detroit Edison Company, then called the Eastern Michigan Edison Company, immediately looked at the Huron River as a local source of hydropower. A consultant for the Detroit Edison Company named Gardner Stewart Williams surveyed the river and drafted a plan for harnessing electricity from the Huron. By 1910, Detroit Edison acquired the rights necessary to begin construction. The plan was to build or refurbish 9 dams. 6 were completed, with the project cut short when the Great Depression hit. 4 of these dams were located in Ann Arbor. Barton, built in 1912, Argo, refurbished in 1913, Geddes, built in 1919, and Superior, constructed in 1920. Each dam was built around 30 feet high, but varied greatly in length, storage, and power output, depending on which section of the Huron Williams selected. Barton was the biggest, stretching 1,767 feet and boasting a typical storage of 5,050 acre-feet, while the much smaller Superior was just 496 feet long with a storage volume of 700 acre-feet. Time for some human drama. Barton Dam wasn't a year old before tragedy struck. Sunday, March 19th, 1913 was sunny but chilly in Ann Arbor. 2 young men and 2 young women decided to enjoy the day by renting a canoe and paddling around the Barton Reservoir just upstream of the dam. 3 were UM students, and a 4th had recently graduated and returned to Ann Arbor with her fiancé and was on the water this fine day catching up with friends. Spring floods made the river high and fast, but the foursome didn't have much trouble navigating the newly created reservoir. It was starting to get dark when they decided to head for home. The safest and smartest route around the dam and back down the river to the canoe livery was to paddle opposite the powerhouse and portage down the embankment to the river below, then shove off in the calm waters. For whatever reason, they instead decided to bump to the edge of the dam and carry the canoe down a series of stairs built into the side of the powerhouse next to a discharge spillway, where spinning turbines expelled water downstream like giant rapids. They put the canoe in the water, piled in, and shoved off. And that's when they realized their terrible mistake. Rather than shoot off down the river on a wave of water, they were sucked back towards the powerhouse and into the spillway by the violently churning water. They paddled like mad, but the vortex drew them closer until it capsized the canoe, sucking all four into the dam's works. They were lucky they didn't drown right then. The force pushed them out of the churn and into the spillway, which was partially above water, and they were able to cling to a thin, 4-foot-long ledge in freezing cold water up to their necks. It was 6:30 p.m., and they were already exhausted. They clung together in the near pitch black, screaming for help, but the sound of the rushing water and the turbines inside drowned them out or played tricks with the acoustics. On-duty plant operator Walter Yost heard voices during one of his regular inspections of the dam, but assumed they came from rowdy kids somewhere along the banks of the river. After a while, one of the boys took matters into his own hands and decided to swim for it. Three times he dove into the black and tried to swim out the chamber, and three times he was pushed back by the churning water. With a water escape ruled out, they felt along the edges of the chamber for some kind of opening and located a trap door in the ceiling above. They pushed and pushed, but it wouldn't budge. Desperate, the boy tried to swim out one more time. He never came back. The three remaining boaters hoped for the best, but an hour later, neither the boy nor the cavalry arrived. Quote, "This is a poor way to entertain a guest," one of the women joked to the visiting graduate, trying to keep their spirits up. Their bodies got colder. It was nearly impossible to see. Occasionally, they spoke through blue lips and chattering teeth to confirm that they were all still alive. Three voices became two. It was now 9:30 p.m., and they'd been in the freezing cold water for 3 hours. At 10 p.m., Walter Yost heard voices again, and this time suspected they were coming from below. He slid a heavy toolbox off a trapdoor and looked down into the egress chamber and shone the light from his lantern into the dark. Clinging to the ledge, exhausted, were the two remaining students. Yost took a heavy rope and fashioned a noose, then lowered it to the pair and told the girl to slip it around her waist. Yost yelled for one of his coworkers to help, and together they pulled the rope, raising the girl out of the water. For some reason, the boy grabbed hold of her and clung for his life rather than waiting his turn. His hands were useless, frozen claws, and he quickly lost his grip. If he just waited, he would have made it. Instead, he fell into the water and disappeared into the cold dark. They wrapped the girl in blankets and called for help to look for the others, but it was too dark and cold, and they called off the search until morning. At dawn, they scoured the banks of the Huron, but found no sign of the others. A diver arrived from Detroit 2 days later, equipped with diving gear, air hoses, lead shoes, and iron weights. He descended into the river and had to crawl against the churning water below the dam's egress, fighting the force of the turbine's backwash to search for the bodies of the boys. 100 spectators lined the riverbanks to watch, cheering when the diver came up, but groaning when he came up empty. Volunteers dragged the river, searching every square inch, but they couldn't find the bodies. Finally, nearly a month after the accident, a boy found the body of one of the kids on shore, partly covered in sand. Dozens of volunteers, reinvigorated, scoured the same site for the others and found the second boy's body nearby at the bottom of the river, mostly covered in sand. The girl, the visitor from out of town, was still missing until University of Michigan President Harry Burns Hutchins implored the student body to try one final time to find the body of their missing classmate. And 200 volunteers searched the river all day, then broke out lanterns and searched all night. Two boys in a canoe happened to notice a string in the water, and when they pulled it, the dead girl floated to the surface. It was the string of her corset. When the Ann Arbor News contacted the surviving girl nearly 70 years after the accident, she was 88 years old, living in Elyria, Ohio. She went on to work as a librarian at the Ford Motor Company, then taught languages at Dearborn High School until her retirement in 1959. She preferred not to relive that evening with the reporter, though she said the memories were still vivid. She did share one throwaway detail that wasn't so throwaway. That day on the Huron River, that was the first time she'd ever been in a canoe. Now back to the exciting stuff. Dam history. Ann Arbor's dams continued producing power for Detroit Edison through the 1950s, until coal and natural gas proved more efficient than harnessing hydropower on Michigan's small, relatively flat rivers. In 1963, Detroit Edison sold the four dams back to the city of Ann Arbor, which purchased them for a song, $400,000, $120,000 of which was covered by the Federal Open Spaces Program. The deal ensured Ann Arbor had control of the city's main water supply, helped preserve the river, and opened more avenues for recreational development. The city took control of the dams just in time for the flood of 1968. It rained for seven straight days, a total of 8.1 inches. But the worst of it came Monday through Tuesday night when 5.8 inches of rain fell on the city, flooding basically every neighborhood. The Huron, its tributaries and lakes throughout Ann Arbor rose to their banks, then overflowed, washing out roads, bridges, and a stretch of the Penn Central Railroad tracks, while also flooding homes, businesses, farms, parks, you name it. Police scrambled to help panicked residents in danger from floodwaters, while fire trucks rushed through the city through fender-high floodwaters to fight freak fires. Thousands were without power and 5,000 without phone service in Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti. The Sheriff's Department dispatched police and prisoners from the county jail to sandbag critical areas to prevent further flooding. Three of Ann Arbor's four dams held fast, but suffered enough damage to require expensive reconstruction and repairs. Getty's Dam took the brunt of it. Raging waters knocked the dam out of commission when floodgates jammed halfway open as the heaviest rain started, forcing water to rise higher and higher behind the dam. The water level eventually broke over the dam and its banks, cutting a whole new riverbed along the embankment and wiping out 100 feet of Dixboro Road and part of the railroad tracks. It might have been worse if not for the heroics of city employee Jimmy Kennedy, who pried the floodgates completely open while dangling off the side of the dam, held by the legs by a few brave colleagues. Crews fought the downpour, using heavy equipment to cut additional holes in the dam to allow the water to flow, then dumped truckload after truckload of rock and heavy dirt into the newly created stream to force the water back into the river. To appreciate the scope of flooding that Ann Arbor endured, you have to see the photos in the Ann Arbor District Library archives. When the story is done seriously, visit oldnews.aadl.org and search 1968 flood. You'll see cars parked on the street in water past their wheel wells, people standing outside apartment buildings trying to prevent personal effects from washing into the river, and a section of the train tracks just completely obliterated. Ann Arbor wasn't the only city affected. Citizens in Lansing to Redford dealt with floodwaters as well, which killed two kids on the first night. 18-year-old J.K. Grandy was swept into an open drainage ditch near an apartment complex in Troy and drowned, while 11-year-old Randy Williams was swept through a water pipe in Niles while playing in the flood. The Lock Alpine sewage plant near Saline also sustained heavy damage and lost four 30-gallon drums of chlorine, which went floating down the Huron somewhere. The Washtenaw Health Department was quick to advise the citizenry to clean up following the disaster. Tips on disinfecting tainted water and treating flooded basements full of stagnant water from backed up sewers throughout the city. The cleanup stunk, but the worst part for Ann Arbor's home and business owners was that insurance policies failed to cover most of the flood damage, leaving residents and businesses to foot the bill. Randy Johnston of the Ann Arbor Association of Independent Insurance Agents gave this dismal quote to the Ann Arbor News following the flood. Quote, "In all of property insurance policies, there is no coverage in any form that protects an owner from flooding, sewer backup, and surface water damage. And you can't buy it anyway." End quote. Some damaged cars were covered, and some insured personal property had water damage clauses, but Michiganders were SOL because Michigan isn't a high-risk area for flooding. In the days following the rain, Ann Arbor was littered with natural and man-made debris left behind by the receding waters. Tens of trucks and dozens of volunteers crawled Gallup, Huron, and Riverside Park, trying their best to clear it of trash, tires, and dead fish. The dams were repaired in the early 70s, and for the most part have held fast since. Few leaks here, some sporadic water pumping into the river there, zebra mussels, fishing the odd dead body out of the works. In 1983, Ann Arbor voters approved another bond, this one for $3.2 million, to refurbish Barton and Superior dams to allow for hydropower generation once again. The dams buzzed back to life in 1986, generating power which Ann Arbor sold back to Detroit Edison for between $50 and $60 an hour. Back in 1986, Barton Dam alone could generate enough power to fill about 3% of Ann Arbor's energy needs, while the smaller Superior could power about 2%. The city expected that it would pay off the bond debt by the mid-90s, at which point the funds generated from the dams would turn into city revenue. The city still has a long-term agreement in place with DTE, where they purchase electricity generated by the Huron River. Today, the dams are pretty solid. But what if another flood of 1968 was to happen? In 2008, the Ann Arbor News decided to ask some experts what they thought. Matt Node, then Ann Arbor Environmental Coordinator and definitely owner of a doomsday shelter, said, quote, "There is no doubt it will happen. The only question is when," unquote. City records in 2008 showed 21,083 people living within 100 feet of a floodplain, the areas where water settles. Houses and businesses within this floodplain could flood, or worse, collapse, causing as much as $110 million in damages. Should a 100-year event, or 500-year event, occur, where Ann Arbor receives a record amount of rain in a single day, or gets dumped on for over a terrible wet week, quote, "It would cut the city in half," said Node. The odds of such an event were put at about 0.2%. That seems pretty slim, but 0.2% is 0.2%. And I have a basement, and I'm not that far from the Huron. Stay dry, my friends. Ann Arbor Stories is presented by Rumble Pack Media in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. This episode was written and performed by me, Rich Reddy, with music, sound, and audio engineering by Brian Peters. Thanks once again to the staff of the AADL and their archive staff, who continue to comb the archives, digitizing old newspaper clippings and photos from Ann Arbor's past. You should visit oldnews.aadl.org, put in some search terms, and spend some quality time in the past. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Ann Arbor Stories, or email us at annarborstories@gmail.com and let us know how we're doing. See you in 2 weeks.